This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have a radio special on the life of Woody Guthrie.
It's brought to you by the great folklorist and guitarist and banjo player Eli Smith and his father Michael Smith. And it's my favorite show to listen to. I love it. Just remember, this guitar kills fascists.
We'll also hear a recording of presentations at the National Lawyers Guild New York City Chapter's award dinner.
We guarantee it will be interesting because who did they honor? Our own Michael Smith. And you have two of the funniest people on what we call left-wing car talk talking about Michael, Heidi and Michael Ratner.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Bogosian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Ratner, WikiLeaks has been in the news again, this time involving the president of France.
And it's an amazing combination of circumstances, actually. June 19th is the third anniversary, or was, of Julian Assange being in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. It's actually the fifth anniversary of him being in some form of custody. That's when he first had to wear a bracelet because of the allegations in Sweden. Of course, Sweden never went ahead with the case, or at least they haven't yet. The U.S. continues to say they have a wide-ranging investigation of Julian and WikiLeaks, et cetera, et cetera. But despite that, and despite him living in this very confined embassy, WikiLeaks is incredibly active. I'm actually quite amazed what goes on there. So a couple of weeks ago, in fact, on June 3rd, part of the agreement of the Trade and Services Agreement, 17 secret documents were revealed by WikiLeaks on negotiations which cover the U.S., European Union, and 23 other countries. So that happened on June 3rd, a secret agreement, another one of those the U.S. is trying to negotiate without the American people knowing. A few days later, on June 10th, WikiLeaks released part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. This is the trend that gave transparency to the healthcare annex, another big trade agreement the U.S. has tried to negotiate. And then on June 19th, actually the actual anniversary of Julian being in the embassy, they released the first tranche of what they call the Saudi cables, 70,000 cables of what will eventually be 700,000 cables concerning really a lot of Saudi Arabian business. But particularly a number of people who are trying to get money from the Saudis, some of whom I think, if you go to the WikiLeaks page, it's wikileaks.org, you can search those cables and see stories on them. So that's the third release in June. And the fourth one, which has caused a big stir recently, is what WikiLeaks refers to as the Espionage Elysee. Elysee is the presidential palace in France. These are NSA cables about the amount of spying, surveilling they're doing of France. And according to these cables, they've surveilled the last three presidents of France, including the current one, President Hollande. And the cables give apparently the names and the phone numbers of various people that they've surveilled. WikiLeaks said in its release today, June 23rd, WikiLeaks began publishing Espionage Elysee, a collection of top secret intelligence reports and documents from U.S. National Security Agency concerning targeting and signals intelligence intercepts of the communications of high-level officials from successive French governments over the last 10 years. This caused quite a bit of consternation in France, and today as we speak, they're holding a meeting about what to do about this. It's a high-level meeting called by the president.
Now, I understand that President Obama has gone on record recently as saying that the NSA is going to stop, or asking them to stop, spying on the heads of our allied countries.
You know, I would not believe what I hear. That's what I would say is the lesson from
right,
all of this.
Right.
But in any case, it's two or three points that I think they're really important. One is that Julian, despite the circumstances and their dire that he's in the sense that it's very difficult conditions, has been able to continue to work, and WikiLeaks has gotten out this incredible material. Secondly, the content of the material has been quite extraordinary. Saudi cables, that's an opening on a country that should be wider open for sure, because this is the closest of allies to the United States in all the dastardly deeds it does around the Middle East in particular. So we like seeing the can of worms of Saudi Arabia wide open. And of course, every time they think they're putting to rest the surveillance of the European heads of state, here we have WikiLeaks coming out again, or coming out with saying, look what they're doing now, look what they've done for the last 10 years.
The limbs are bending down. I pick them all day for a dollar, boys, as I go rambling around. As I go rambling around.
Woodrow Wilson Guthrie, Woody Guthrie, was born, fittingly enough, 100 years ago on Bastille Day, July 14, 1912, in Okemah, Oklahoma. Music festivals around the country will be marking this centennial. Many of us know Woody by his most famous song, This Land Is Your Land, but he recorded many, many other songs, essentially a writer and a cartoonist, biographer, extremely productive. His Dust Bowl songs, his songs about the Pacific Northwest, are all American classics and chronicled at the Smithsonian Museum. Today, we're joined by Eli Smith to talk about Woody Guthrie, his life and his music. Eli is a folklorist, a banjo player, writer, and a researcher, and has recently come out on Smithsonian Folkways Records, the same record company that produced Woody Guthrie's records, with the album The Old Man Below. Eli has an internet radio show called Down Home Radio Show, and we're real glad to have him on the program. Eli, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Hey, glad to be here. Glad to be back.
You know, a lot of people have been influenced by Woody Guthrie. Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Bob Dylan went out to see him towards the end. And I know you've been very influenced by Woody Guthrie yourself. Tell us a little bit about Woody.
Well, Woody Guthrie would have been 100 years old had he lived to 100 this year. He was born on July 14th, Bastille Day, in a little town called Okemah, Oklahoma. As I say, July 14th, 1912. He moved here to New York, to Brooklyn, in 1940, so there's a lot of events going around the city to mark his 100th birthday. Of course, Woody Guthrie is the author of the well-known song, This Land Is Your Land, maybe an early kind of power to the people song, often known as a kind of second national anthem, for at least for some people here in America, sung by school children and so on. But actually, Woody Guthrie was really a radical guy. He was a socialist, just a radical artist in his era, working with the young Pete Seeger and Leadbelly and numbers of other folk singers in the early New York City folk music scene in the 1940s.
Before he came to New York and really settled here, he came from Oklahoma, went out to Texas, went out to California, had some experience underneath his belt before he came to New York. I suppose that's what so entranced radicals in New York. Woody Guthrie was the real thing. Talk about some of his experience and what he brought to New York City.
Well, Woody Guthrie played up his authenticity card quite a lot as a hobo and a rambling man and an authentic country personality. He was much more than that. His father was a successful businessman in real estate and stuff out in Oklahoma in the boom times there in the early 20th century, in the 20s. But then Woody's family suffered some real tragic events which put Woody out on the road. So he had grown up in kind of a stable middle class kind of family in Oklahoma in a little town. But then his mother began to suffer from Huntington's disease, the disease that ultimately killed Woody Guthrie in 1967 at the age of 55. But it began to affect his mother. She was committed to an insane asylum, and his father suffered business setbacks, and his sister was killed in a fire. And all these things destroyed their family and set Woody Guthrie on the road at a young age, where he interacted with migrant workers and so on in the Great Depression era and the Dust Bowl conditions of environmental degradation in the Southwest in the 1930s, and that brought him to California.
On that trip, because he went from Oklahoma to California, Eli, and he traveled with migrant workers on that, I understand. Well, and he also wrote a song about migrant workers, so maybe it's a time to just at least mention that song and what that song is. And
Woody Guthrie did travel with migrant workers. Of course, there were hundreds of thousands or millions of migrant workers that were riding the rails and so on in the 1930s. It was the great era for that, when working-class Americans hit the road to try to find work anywhere that they could. In California, Woody started his career also as a radio personality, playing on the radio music. He was already writing and painting. He was a multifaceted artist, which he wrote many songs about migrant workers. The deportees song, the plane wreck at Los Gatos Canyon. Woody never recorded that song. It was set to music later. I don't really like the tune that it was set to, but looking at the words, you can kind of tell what tune Woody actually set it to. Woody Guthrie, I don't believe he ever wrote an original melody. He was just a writer of words and a very, very talented one. I believe Woody Guthrie wrote the Deportees song to the tune of Get Along Little Dogies, Whoopie Tie Io, Get Along Little Dogies.
Right, it's called, I think, Deportee, parentheses says, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos. Right, and refers to, I guess, about migrants going somewhere, home, and a plane
wreck. Well, I think
they
were deporting Mexicans back to Mexico, and there was an airplane which crashed and killed them. So he wrote a song commemorating that.
Eli, I understand that Woody also wrote political articles, books, even autobiographical sketches for radical newspapers. And
that's right.
He was a hater of injustice, but remained optimistic.
Yeah, definitely. Woody Guthrie started out writing a column for the Communist Party newspaper in California called the People's Daily World, I think it was called. And he continued that column in New York with the
Daily Worker.
The Daily Worker, thank you. And his column was called Woody Says, which was basically the same thing as Will Rogers' column, which I think was called Will Rogers Says. Woody loved Will Rogers, another Oklahoman. He was a Native American and an early sort of stand-up comic, and he was the host of Ziegfeld's Follies in New York, very, very famous political commentator. In any case, Woody really admired Will Rogers and kind of modeled himself on Will Rogers and also on Walt Whitman in terms of his writing and his poetry. So Woody Guthrie was a public intellectual, not just a folk singer. Not only was he a writer and performer of songs, but he also wrote poetry and he wrote prose, and he wrote, newspaper opinion pieces. And he was also a talented painter and visual artist. He was really a Renaissance man, and much of that work has been published in the years since his death. His landmark autobiographical novel, Bound for Glory, was published in 1943. Definitely a part of the proletarian novel sort of format. But also prefigured people like Jack Kerouac in a lot of ways in terms of being on the road and, experiencing life from the bottom up as kind of an outsider. It was very, very interesting and very innovative. Would hope that people would also recognize him in that fashion as well.
I read that he also wrote children's songs.
Woody Guthrie had 8 children over the course of his life. And he loved kids. He was kind of a big kid himself in some ways. And he did several albums of children's songs for the Folkways record label, now the Smithsonian Folkways record label. And, they're just wonderful songs, and those albums continue to be some of his most popular work.
I also understand he wrote Yiddish songs.
He wrote his second wife, Marjorie Matzier Greenblatt, was Jewish, and they lived together in Coney Island in a Jewish section of town. Woody started to write some sort of Jewish-themed songs. He wrote some Hanukkah songs, and it's funny because they're very droll and southwestern, but celebrating Hanukkah and stuff.
I'm anxious to listen to them. But I have a question. Arlo was one of the products of that marriage, I think.
Sure.
We've talked about This Land Is Your Land, and actually a couple of questions about that. I go to one baseball game a year. I went yesterday or last week to the Yankees-Cleveland game, and of course, there was a catch that the guy didn't really catch the ball, and then the Indians, who are my home team from Cleveland, which is not politically correct, but that's who they're called, but the Cleveland baseball team lost the game 6-4. At the end of like the seventh inning, they stood up and they played God Bless America, Kate Smith recording, your dad tells me. And I said to my neighbors at the time, knowing that I was going to interview you the next day, saying, I think Woody Guthrie wrote This Land Is Your Land as a counter to God Bless America. What do you know about that?
Well, as far as I know, Woody Guthrie was kind of traveling around and hoboing around, and he kept hearing that song on jukeboxes. he really hated sort of that insipid pop music that's been droning on the airwaves for like, you know, almost 100 years now. So he composed This Land Is Your Land as kind of a response to that song. He set his words to a hymn that he probably grew up with or heard on a Carter Family record called When the World's on Fire. And that tune probably came into his head, and he wrote out the words. And he wrote that song a number of years before it was first recorded. But since that time, it's really become sanitized because they kind of took out the more communistic verses. But it has become very well known, and as I say, is kind of a second national anthem along with America the Beautiful.
When he says this land is your land, do you have any sense of who he's referring to as the your? Is it just white Europeans who came? Is it everybody who's here? Who is it?
Through his song, he's trying to tell you that this land is your land, whoever you might be. And in his mind, that would be the working class of whatever stripe or skin color.
There are a couple of verses to that song that are so wonderful. Obama was inaugurated. Pete Seeger was down in Washington at rally, and he sang the two verses that had been previously really censored. And I wonder if you could do those verses for the audience.
Well, you asked me to sing a bit of This Land Is Your Land with the often excluded verses that Woody wrote. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. Was a great high wall there that tried to stop me. A sign was painted, said private property, but on the back side, it didn't say nothing. That sign was made for you and me. And then there's another verse, maybe this is the one you're thinking of, that says, in the squares of the city, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. And as they stood there hungry, I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Excellent. That was really moving.
Those verses are subversive. Eli, is there another song or two of Woody's that are particularly favorites of yours that you'd like to share with us?
We'd love to hear it.
Well, I have another Woody Guthrie song that I'd like to play for you on your show. And it's a lesser-known one. Of course, This Land Is Your Land is his best-known song. But here's one called I've Got to Know, which Woody did record and which was also recorded in a nice version by Utah Phillips. I've Got to Know by Woody Guthrie, set to the tune of the hymn Farther Along. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. Why do your war boats ride on my waters? Why do your death bombs fall from my sky? Why do you burn my farm and my town down? I've got to know, friend, I've got to know. What makes your boats haul death to my people? Nitro blockbusters, big cannons and guns. Why don't your ship bring food and some clothing? I've got to know, yes, I've sure got to know. Why can't my two hands get a good paid job? I can still plow, plant, I can still sow. Why did your law book chase me off my good land? I've got to know, friend, I've just got to know. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. What good work did you do? I'd like to ask you to give you my money right out of my hands. I built your big house to hide from my people. Why do you hide so? I've got to know. You keep me in jail, you lock me in prison. Your hospital's jammed and your crazy house full. What made your cop kill my trade union worker? You'll have to talk plain, 'cause I've got to know. Why can't I get work and cash a big paycheck? Why can't I buy things in your place and your store? Why do you close my plant down and starve my buddies? I'm asking you, I've got to know. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know.
Great, Eli.
That's a beautiful
Thank
song.
You.
I had never heard that song, but you know, you could have written that song yesterday.
It's a lesser known one. Yeah, it seems quite contemporary.
Woody Guthrie died in 1967. You were born in 1982.
That's right.
You're 30, and he would have been 100. But he reached out over these decades, and I know you were very interested in him since you were a teenager. Talk to us about how he's influenced you and what you're doing with respect to his music.
Woody Guthrie has been very influential to a lot of people. For me, I always loved his songs, and being a leftist politically, I enjoyed that aspect of Woody Guthrie, but I always also enjoyed him as a folk musician from the Southwest, and a good old-time musician. He played the guitar as well as the mandolin, the fiddle, and the harmonica. And he was a wonderful musician. I loved his sound from the first moment that I heard it. So that's what I really liked about Woody Guthrie in addition to his politics. A lot of people just take his music as, you know, kind of a liberal or left political song, but I really concentrated on his style, and I'm an old-time string band musician. I record for the Smithsonian Folkways record label, as Woody Guthrie did, and that's been an honor. I get I'm hosting and curating a Woody Guthrie at 100 tribute concert at the Jalopy Theater on July 14th, Woody Guthrie's actual 100th birthday. That's on Saturday, July 14th, and at the Jalopy Theater, 315 Columbia Street in the Carroll Gardens, Red Hook area of Brooklyn. Jalopy.biz is the website. Or you can check out my internet radio show, Down Home Radio, downhomeradioshow.com, where I'll be posting information about the Woody Guthrie tribute at the Jalopy Theater. We're going to have a number of performers performing his songs, including myself, as well as John Cohen from the New Lost City Ramblers. I'll be reading from Woody Guthrie's works of poetry and prose, Jamie Longy will be there to read from his father's memoir. Jamie's father served with Woody Guthrie in the Merchant Marines in World War II. The Dust Bowl and World War II were the primary events in Woody Guthrie's life. So Jamie will be reading a little bit about that as well. We'll also be screening a short film, which is the only footage of Woody Guthrie in his prime. It's a film called To Hear Your Banjo Play that was made by Alan Lomax in the 1940s and is narrated by a young Pete Seeger. And it's just a wonderful film and features some wonderful performance footage of Woody Guthrie. So if you want to hear a whole bunch of his music performed by some great contemporary performers, as well as all that other stuff, come down to the Jalopy on July 14th and help us celebrate Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday.
And Eli, if we want to hear some of your music, how do we get that?
If you'd like to hear my band's new album on the Smithsonian Folkways record label, you can go to our website, dustbustersmusic.com, for more information on that. The album will be out in mid-August.
Eli Smith, it's been great. I've listened to your music since you've been a little kid. I went to the Brooklyn Folk Festival, heard you there, and hearing you play Woody Guthrie here was just wonderful. And, of course, your history and knowledge of Woody Guthrie is extraordinary. So thank you very much, Eli Smith.
Thank you, Eli.
Thank you, Eli.
Well, thanks a lot. And, of course, Michael Smith here is my dad, and it's just like the Alan Sherman thing, my son, the folk singer. So here we are. And thanks for having me on the show.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
It drove us miners out of doors, out from the houses that the company owned. We moved into tents up at Old Ludlow. I was worried bad about my children, soldiers guarding the railroad bridge. Every once in a while a bullet would fly, kick up gravel under my feet. We were so afraid you'd kill our children, dug us a cave that's 7 foot deep, carried our young ones and a pregnant woman down inside the cave to sleep. That very night you soldiers waited till all us miners was asleep. You snuck around our little tent town, soaked our tents with your kerosene. You struck a match and the blaze it started. You pulled the triggers of your Gatling guns. I made a run for the children, but a firewall stopped me. 13 children died from your guns. I carried my blanket to a wire fence corner, watched the fire till the blaze died down. I helped some people drag their belongings while your bullets killed us all around. I never will forget the look on the faces, the men and women that awful day, when we stood around to preach their funeral and to lay the corpse of the dead away. We told the Colorado governor to phone the president, tell him call off his National Guard. But the National Guard belonged to the governor, so he didn't try so very hard. Our women from Trinidad, they hauled some potatoes up to Wallensburg in a little cart. They sold their potatoes and brought some guns back, and they put a gun in every hand. The state soldiers jumped us in the wire fence corners, did not know that we had these guns. And the redneck miners mowed down them troopers. You should have seen them poor boys run. We took some cement and walled the cave up, where you killed these 13 children inside. I said, God bless the mine workers' union. Then I hung my head.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
On May 29th of this year, the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild honored our own Michael Smith at their annual dinner.
What the heck for? Oh, no, someone told me, I know what. Someone said that because you're on this show with him.
Oh, yeah?
That this is like the left car talk. So I think they gave it to him for Law and Disorder.
I think they did.
No, but we can be serious.
Yeah.
Michael's had a life...
illustrious career.
Life of activism that continues unabated.
Exactly. From Cuba work, which I think is partially why they honored him.
To leafleting in the streets. Anti-war work.
We introduced him with Jim Lafferty.
He got the Champion of Justice, which actually is a big deal.
It is.
The Guild is an important long-term organization from the 1930s. New York City chapter is one of its most important. It's a big honor to get it. Heidi, as you said, you and I and Jim Lafferty introduced Michael.
We took the stage, yes.
And you'll enjoy our introductions. You'll enjoy Michael's talk. You'll hear about why he has become, or always was, a champion of justice. Right. And he's also co-host of the most important radio show on the left.
It's a legal affairs show, Michael.
Oh, sorry. It's a legal affairs show.
Yeah.
We try and remember that.
Right. and he's just also a really wonderful human being.
So we're really happy they honored Michael, to put it mildly.
Yes. So let's take a listen at all of us introducing him and his wonderful remarks.
You're going to enjoy this, just like we have enjoyed being with Michael on the show.
For 11 years.
And in other parts of our lives. 11 years? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. 11 years.
What are we going to say about this?
We're going to split this up.
I have no thoughts at all.
Okay, Michael, where are you?
when I came to the Guild... in the tradition of a real guild, Michael reached out to me, took me to the top of the World Trade Center for a meal. I was too afraid to tell him that I was terrified of heights because he was so kind and enthusiastic about it.
We actually went twice. He introduced me to Len Wineglass, and we interviewed Kathy Boudin for Guild Notes. And then he invited me to be part of Law and Disorder radio show. And over the last 10 years, he's been a mentor and a true friend and a joy to work with. Ever gracious, I learned of Michael's exuberance for humanity and his profound empathy for the human condition, especially when subjected to the transgressions of a lawless United States government. In writing Who Killed Che, How the CIA Got Away with Murder with Michael Ratner, and The Emerging Police State, which he edited, we see the issues he cares about, revealing corrupt power at the expense of the people. It is fitting that we honor Michael tonight for his work on behalf of Cuba. Yet his moral compass impels him to take action whenever government entities trespass on our rights. He did this with Lynn Stewart, our beloved Lynn, with Stephen Saleda, with Jeremy Hammond. He organized panels on the Cuban Five and on Lynn's case, printing both into Guild booklets. Lynn's so popular that we ran out thousands in a few weeks. The Guild's mantra, human rights over property interests, resonate with all of us. But for those who know Michael, it's no secret that he has a keen eye for some of the finer things in life, such as a well-tailored Italian suit. I love the fact that we can talk about extraordinary rendition on a Wednesday in one sentence, and then whisper offhand about the grading scale of men's suits, something that Michael taught me. It's no wonder that our Cuban counterparts and all who know him have a deep and abiding affection for you, Michael. Thank you for everything and congratulations.
Well, thank you, Heidi. Heidi is, as you know, part of our Law and Disorder program, and she clearly has the best voice of the three of us, which is Michael, myself, and Heidi. My wife referred to the Law and Disorder program with the interaction of Michael, myself, and Heidi as the left car talk, which sounds about right. In any case, when I looked at this program, I saw this ad that actually I placed with Heidi and Karen, and it has a picture of Michael Smith with some huge fish. It says he's also a hell of a fisherman. Now, I was going to open with a story about I'm going fishing tomorrow with his brother-in-law in Wisconsin. But Michael Smith is not coming with us. And there's a reason for that. We've taken him before. He always brings some big books, because if you know Michael, he reads a huge amount. And we wear these rubber suits, and we walk through the woods. And all of a sudden, while we're walking on the stream, there's no Michael to be found. And it takes about 30 minutes, and of course, he's reading a book, but then falls asleep in the high grass. And he's somewhere downstream. So no longer does Michael Smith fish with us any longer. In any case,
and then he catches the biggest fish.
But this is cheating. This is not fly fishing. This is nothing. Anyway, I've known Michael, Debbie, and Eli for 35 years. For a long time, they lived around the corner in the village. We then became closer as we started to edit books together. Heidi mentioned one of them, Who Killed Che, which was our latest Che book. There was an earlier one, which was the FBI-CIA file about Che, and the favorite line that Michael and I discovered in the book, you know, utterly racist, was an FBI agent who was, or an informant living in the camp with Che in the Sierra Maestra, saying, Che is very smart for a Latino. That's the level of our FBI. Anyway, that was book one. Book two was Who Killed Che? And by this time, I was tired of it all, but Michael, as he does with incredible energy, went to Argentina and did the book opening with 25 interviews in 4 days, went to Cuba when they published it there a few weeks ago, again, dozens of interviews, went to the book fair, and because Cuba wants every person to have a book, they were selling the books for less than 50 cents. As I said, I've known them for a long time. Debbie was actually the editor of the first book. Another book, when I was in Cuba last week, and of course I thought about Michael, I go into a bookstore, and there's a book by Joe Slovo, there's The Diary of Che,
And on top of that is a book Heidi mentioned, Michael's edited book of Bill Kunstler's speeches, The Emerging Police State. So Michael's material is pervasive around everywhere. One other book I should mention is Michael's Notebook for 60s Radicals. Now I looked, Notebook of a Lawyer's Notebook for 60 Radicals. What is it, Michael? What's the name? Okay, that's, I couldn't find it today, but don't worry about that. Michael has boxes of them left. So feel free to ask Michael for a copy of that book.
Maybe at a discounted price, maybe not.
Maybe at a discounted. And the book he's proudest of is the one he did with Debbie and Francis Golden, who was here, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And then, of course, I'd be remiss to not mention directly his politics. He's been a political person, as far as I can tell, certainly his whole life, and certainly since Wisconsin, where he went to school. And now that he's given up a lot of his law practice, if not almost all of it, he's really happy because he can do political work all of the time. And you know, I consider myself to be a bit sophisticated politically, but Michael is way, way ahead of me. So 2 years ago, we're both anti-Zionists, and we're having a discussion, and 3 years ago, Michael says to me, forget the two-state solution. It's a one-state solution. Two states is nothing, nothing but a way Israel is going to keep gobbling up Palestinian land. And of course, I said, Michael, that's unrealistic, but of course he was right. And if you followed the Stephen Saleta case, the man who lost his job at Champaign-Urbana, he considered that case to be a critical case in the country for free speech as well as Palestine rights. So he's out front, he's on the barricades, and he's taking on the issues that are the most important, in my view, in this country. And then there's two other quick anecdotes. Michael, technology, email, and that kind of stuff. So he sends emails constantly every day, if any of you are on, 30 or 40 of them. You don't have to do any reading of New York Times or anything, because every article about everything in the world, particularly from a left perspective, you will get on email, and he will ask you the next day whether you've read them. Well, but sometimes they can be funny. The one I got was this one recently that said, I got this on Wednesday. I got an Apple Watch. All I have to do is look at my wrist to tell the time. Now, there's no way Michael got an Apple Watch, because no one in the world can use an Apple Watch. But in any case, that was that email. Anyway, I'll end on this note. The other day, I'm at the Brooklyn Folk Festival. It's run by Eli. It's an incredible event, which I recommend going to. And one of the great performances on Friday night was by a young musician named Blind Boy Paxton. And he's introducing himself, and he says, I'm so pleased that my ma and my pa are in the audience. And you know who he was referring to? He was referring to Debbie and Michael. And I want to end on saying, not just are Debbie and Michael Blind Boy Paxton's ma and pa, but in some way, they're the ma and pa of all of us. And I think that's the most amazing thing. And I always say that Michael would give anyone here the shirt off his back. And then I thought of the last little joke about that. I think he'd give anybody the shirt off his back, unless it was a shirt that had the face of Leon Trotsky on it. Anyway, on that note, I'm happy to have to introduce Jim, who's going to then talk about Michael a bit.
No. There's a brother over here holding up a sign that says, oh, time, you're being very generous. The time has long been up, but they're giving me a minute. I appreciate that. I'll be very brief, because I think we have taken our time. I just want to make 2 points following up, but I agree with everything that these two folks have said. I had the privilege and honor of writing the bio that's in your journal, so you can read my thoughts in there in great detail. But I want to make another point about his politics and about Michael the person. I've known him for 45 years. He's been a revolutionary socialist for all of those 45 years. And during that period of time, I've known many fine activists who, because of the changing winds of the times, have sometimes not stayed on this, what I might think of, or Michael might think of, as the straight and narrow, even as they continue to do their great work. But that's not Michael. And it always reminds me, when I think of Michael in that regard, of what Lillian Hellman, many of you remember this, said, the famous quote when she was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. She said, I will not tailor my political beliefs to suit the fashions of the times. And that's true of Michael Smith completely. No matter which way the political winds are blowing, whether it might be to his advantage or not, Michael Smith knows that revolutionary socialism is the way forward. That's his belief. That's all the wonderful writing that he's done, all the wonderful movement work that he's done, the work around Cuba, is all on behalf of that understood principle from which he never deviates. And lastly, not only will Michael give you the shirt off his back, I just wanted to comment on that, because it's true, of course. If you have Michael Smith as a friend, you have a friend for life. You have someone who will not only give you the shirt off his back, but will go to the ends of the earth if you need him to be there for you. And that's because he not only has that broad love of all humanity, but the love of the individuals as well. The love of the individuals as well. In fact, sometimes if you take a walk with Michael down the streets of New York, it can take a lot longer than you thought it was going to take, because I've never walked down the streets with him when you passed a homeless person and he didn't stop and put something in the cup and have a few words to say to that homeless person. The big picture, the small picture, the big crisis, the small needs, none of them escape this big-hearted guy, folks. So it's been my privilege to be his friend for all of these years. I honor you. I love you, Michael. You're the dearest man in my life. Let us all honor Michael Smith.
Thank you for those overly generous but graciously accepted remarks. I'm here with my wife Debbie and my son Eli. I met Debbie 40 years ago on March 8th on International Women's Day. I'd organized a book party for a feminist anthropologist at NYU Law School, invited Debbie to come to it with me, and we've been together ever since. And I'm here with my son, Eli, who is with his band, the Downhill Strugglers. They're going to play for you all. They play old-time music. This summer, they're going on a tour for the Library of Congress. They're playing the Newport Folk Festival, the Vancouver Festival, many others. And they're ending up at the Kennedy Center. So they're very good, and we're all in for a treat. And they play dance music, too, so I'm looking forward to that. Thank you, Eli. I came to New York from Detroit, where I was a member of a Lawyers Guild firm in Detroit. Jim Lafferty, who had been the executive director of the Lawyers Guild, was in the firm. Dennis James, also became the executive director of the Lawyers Guild, was my partner. Dennis is here. Ron Riosti was in the firm. Ron is here, came from Detroit. Abdeen Jabara was in the firm. Abdeen is here. He's the husband of Holly McGuigan. And our firm was regularly spied on by the Detroit political police, who used to break into our offices, go through our files, take photographs of us. And one of our partners, Dick Sobel, who was the vice president of the Lawyers Guild, brought a FOIA lawsuit, and we got the Detroit Secret Police dossier on our law firm. I want to read to you what they concluded, because I thought it was so flattering that my publisher actually used it as a blurb on the back of my book, Notebook of a 60s Lawyer, which is available in the back for $10. This is what Lieutenant Dennis Mullaney of the Detroit Police Department Red Squad inner office memo of December 1, 1970 had to say. There was hardly an underground newspaper, Black Liberation, or left-wing group of any kind in Detroit that at one time or another was not represented by the law firm of Lafferty, Riosti, Jabara, Papakian and Stickgall, James, Smith, and Sobel. That endorsement sold a lot of books. So when I came to New York and took and passed the bar exam, the next hurdle was getting through the character and fitness committee. And because of this kind of practice I had in those days, it was a serious concern. The guy that I sat next to at NYU Law School actually had to hire Leonard Boudin for advice on how to get through the character and fitness committee. So I put on a suit, took the train up to the Appellate Division, First Department on Madison Avenue. I went in, a little fearful, to speak with the man who was going to interview me about my character and fitness. I walked in the room. It was an older gentleman, very Ivy League, came from one of those white shoe law firms. I think it was White and Case. Let's call him Mr. White. And he was extremely cordial. And I thought, maybe it's because of my name, Smith. Little did he know that the name had been changed. It had been Cooper Smith. It means barrel maker in Yiddish. My father's great-grandfather and his brother hated each other, and they divided everything they owned in half, including the name, and that's how I got to be a Smith. So I'm sitting there with Mr. White, and he says, I see that you've come from Detroit, Mr. Smith, that you had a firm there. I said, yes, yes. He said, well, you know, I used to go to Detroit a lot. I had a client in Detroit. I said, really? He said, yes, Chrysler. And then he said, and what kind of practice did you have, Mr. Smith? I said, general practice. And then he asked me the question that ended the interview. He said, Mr. Smith, do you come from a long line of lawyers, or are you breaking new ground? I said, Mr. White, when I graduated high school, I was breaking new ground. That sufficiently discouraged him. He concluded the interview. I got admitted to practice, and 6 months later, Richard Nixon was disbarred. I just want to say a couple of thank yous, and then I'll be finished. To Susan Howard and Elena Cohn, and to my friend Ann Schneider from Wisconsin, thank you for pulling this together. And thank you all my friends and comrades who agreed to be on the honorary committee and for coming out and showing such nice support. And last, I also wanted to mention three of my friends who are seriously ill and couldn't be here. Bill Schaap, who did such wonderful work for the Guild during the anti-war movement in the 60s. His companion, Ellen Ray, who was the co-chair of the International Committee along with Len Wineglass. And a wonderful friend of a lot of us, Kathy Boudin. So let's give a shout out to them. And just lastly, thank you so much. I really, truly appreciate your recognition. Thank you.
Want to hear Law and Disorder again? Go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.